time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. My guest today is Russ Kassoff, and he's an accomplished jazz pianist, conductor, composer, orchestrator, and arranger. And he's done it all. This is our part three show. Welcome to the show, Russ.
It's so great to be back here. It's, you know, we've been talking so much that I've actually purchased a plan just to call this number.
Thank you, Russ. Thank you. Well, you know, you're on my Facebook page now, and we met courtesy of Glenn Zatola.
And, oh, yes.
Yep, and I saw you playing piano in the park. You did piano in the park, and you have some great pictures with your funny faces playing the piano. You know, tell me a little bit about that. It sounds like you've been doing that for a long time.
I don't know exactly how many years. It's probably 8 or 9 years now. It's a really, really great series that's produced by Local 802 and Susie Siegel, who's in upper management over at the park. And it's just a fantastic event when the weather's good, and most of the time it is. We average about 300 people for each afternoon, and they just come by and they sit at a table and they bring their lunch and they just enjoy the ambiance of the park, which right now is incredibly beautiful. And I get to play for them for 2 hours, and it's not really requests. It's kind of like what I want to share with them in the music that I like to play, and occasionally I'll get a request. And the most amazing thing is that people from my life, I mean, I'm currently, pardon the expression, 62 years old, that I haven't seen in 30 or 40 years that may just by chance work around Midtown Manhattan that walk through the park, all of a sudden they come up to me and they say, Russ! And they know what I look like, but I never know what they look like. And they get offended because I don't recognize them after 40 years. You know, for most of them, I missed the hair years.
Right.
But it's incredible. It's like one of my favorite gigs every year. And this year, I get to do it twice. I'm going to do it again the week of August 22nd.
Okay. Now, do people get up just from the park, people coming by, and sing? Is it a sing-along?
No. That happens once a week, and there are only certain people that really like to do that. I'm one of them. Mostly, it's a jazz series, different great pianists. They each get a week, and they just play their thing. And everybody is great in their own way and very different. And my kind of area of expertise is eclecticism. I play a lot of different kinds of music, a lot of jazz and a lot of pop and a lot of great American songbook stuff. And on Thursday, they have created these books. They have a Broadway in the Park series where actual casts from Broadway, 4 or 5 of them, they perform on the stage on the opposite end, and about 5,000 people show up for that. And right after that, they come over to the piano on the other end, and we pass out these books, and we discover great singers who get up and sing, and we try to get the group to all sing all songs from Broadway shows, and that happens on Thursdays during the summer.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Too bad I'm not a singer.
Well, we could get you up. You know, I always like to tell them that, like, right next door in the cafe, there are men with cigars who are agents who are just looking for people to come up and sing and discover them.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. Now, for people who haven't heard the first two shows that we did, can you just give me some background on who you are? You know, and you've played with a lot of famous people.
Yeah, basically, I've been a musician all my life. I learned how to play piano at the age of 3, with the gratitude to my parents who recognized after they purchased a toy piano, and I started to play along with Bugs Bunny cartoons, that I had a little bit of talent. So they gave me piano lessons, and it evolved. I was mostly classical when I was very young, and I have perfect pitch, which means that I can replicate anything I hear in the tonality that it's in. You know, it's like the opposite of tone deafness, which most people are. But I didn't know that until I was in high school. I thought everybody had perfect pitch. Anyway, I'm self-taught. I took lessons. I followed what my parents played on the radio, which was mostly Frank Sinatra. And through a fortuitous series of events and a journey, I wound up playing for Frank Sinatra for the better part of 11 years, Liza Minnelli for 18. Now I'm with Rita Moreno, and we're going to be touring in October in the Pacific Northwest, and that's going to be great. And I've been with her for about 13 years. And during the course of, like, say, the 80s and 90s, when there was an incredible environment of clubs that featured all kinds of different performers, I was lucky enough to be one of the people that was on the scene that got called to play for a lot of them. So that pretty much is a little bit of a summary.
Okay. Now, you've played for a long time with Frank Sinatra. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit? Because, first off, that's an honor that you were chosen, I think, to do that, and you're quite accomplished yourself. What was it like to play with him, and can you share any stories?
Well, I do, and I did mention in our earlier interview that every second that I was on the gig, it was like magic. When he walked in the room, there was just a certain star stuff about him that made everybody kind of like be on your toes and be better than you normally were. It made you play way ahead of your game. And everybody that was there belonged there. They all had the utmost talents for what they did. And I'm not just talking about the musicians. I'm talking about the crew. I'm talking about people that worked in the theaters and the venues that we played. And he was the consummate interpreter and performer of the Great American Songbook, as it's been come to call in this day. And he had the most unique voice of anyone. I mean, there is no other voice like him. And I was like a kid in a candy store. I sat at the piano and I just couldn't believe that I was there. And it was magic. It was all the pieces. Everyone was a little piece, like a jigsaw puzzle. And individually, we wouldn't all be stars. We wouldn't all be some performer that one would go after to hear, although some of us were. It was the way we put the team together, the puzzle together. It all became the Sinatra magic. It was a recipe for greatness, and everyone from the person sitting in the back row of the string section to the person sitting in the back row of the audience had their experience that equaled something like having magic.
Okay, now what is it, do you think? I mean, you see a lot of people that can sing. There's a lot of talented people out there. What is it that makes some of these people, like Sinatra, get to the top? I mean, obviously you have to have the talent. Is it being in the right place at the right time? Is it having connections? What gives that to them? How do they get there?
How do performers get there, or
yes,
or musicians get to Sinatra?
No, how do performers get to the top? What is it that takes it for someone maybe who's aspiring, you know, to really get to the top and be well known? What does it take?
Well, there are two very individual opinions that I have, and I'm glad you asked. For me, there was a great era of Hollywood and popular singing in which we experienced folks that came, like, say, from Bing Crosby's day or Louis Armstrong's day to Sinatra's day. And there were some really, really great singers. I mean, I would hate to leave anybody out, but I would include Judy Garland, Ella Fitzgerald, Peggy Lee, Vic Damone, Steve Lawrence, Sammy Davis, Dean Martin. There were great performers, people that had charisma, people that had this certain personality on stage that just wrapped you into them. Nowadays, we are a product of the business of the education of music and performance and acting and stuff like that, in which most folks that do become gigantic stars that are young have gone through some sort of a schooling system that didn't really exist quite like then. Like then, it was actually people doing it. Now it's people being products of an education system in which they learned how to do it. So often you'll hear a singer, and I don't want to mention any names because that wouldn't be fair,
right,
but they're over singing. It's kind of like watching The Voice or American Idol or something like that. It's not, you're not looking at the big picture. Everything is a very short gratification moment. And so it's very difficult to name people right now who are stars that or who become stars that are equivalents of the great ones that came in the past. I also happen to believe that it has to do with the environment, the air, the pollution, and the food. We don't have what they had, which was much purer than what we have now. But that's another topic. People study. They are very committed. They try. They're spiritual. They're soulful. They are under the guise of gurus. They study with teachers, this and that. And still, we don't have very many people who are really great entertainers today that can hold themselves up against the entertainers of yesterday. So I'm an old school guy.
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that, because nowadays it seems more like it's about marketing and branding the singer and whatever their gimmick is, so to speak. Even though they might be talented, it's I don't know how to, you know, I look at the old music from, you know, the 40s, the Frank Sinatra style music, where the songs were written and they were beautiful and they were lyrical and there was style and there was class. You know, I think of like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Those songs were great. And now when I listen to the newer music, and I'm talking the last 15 years at least, maybe more, I don't see as much of that. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a product of what the younger generation is exposed to now. Back in the day, there was the opportunity that the older folks, such as myself, I'm sorry to say, had to go to jam sessions and go into clubs and play along with the greats. But you really wouldn't sit in with the greats, even though there were lots of jam sessions, unless you felt that you had prepared yourself to be able to do that and learn from them and contribute to them. Nowadays, people just sit in, and no matter what it is, it's, you know, commercialism has always existed. Rock and roll was an expression of that. There were great rock and roll performers in the 50s, you know, track it back to Elvis and beyond. And then there were these incredible changes like the Beatles and the Stones and all the other groups that developed on that. But even then, classic rock is much different than rock is today. It was much less commercial back then. It was the same kind of expression. You don't get the expression these days. At least that's my experience. People don't have the opportunity to open their minds and attack their belief systems, or at least question them, so that they can create new things that might be accepted by an overall community.
Okay. Now, one of the other things I want to ask you is original songs. A lot of these people, these young people that are singing, you know, in the last 10, 15 years that have started to become more famous, a lot of them, some of them write their own songs, but some don't. So let's say, you know, I've written a song and I can sing. What happens? How do you go out and get yourself exposed? I'm assuming you go and play in, you know, in different venues and you try to market yourself. I'm sure it's very, very different than it was, you know, even 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, nowadays they don't have the same kind of management and agent teams and producers that they used to have. You're pretty much on your own. The internet and social media has made it so that you can produce yourself and you're unfettered, you're unchecked. You're unproduced, you're undirected, and a lot of people just put their stuff out, and that doesn't mean it's any less well-meaning than more talented people, but a classic example is I have a radio show. It's called The Jazz Deli with Russ Kassoff on WFDU HD2, thank you very much, and it's on Saturday mornings, and I am presented, as are all the DJs on our station, which is very, very eclectic, with people's products. Somebody recorded a new CD, here it is. You look at the CD and you see where it came from. We used to have radio promoters. I have my own. Her name is Kate Smith. She's wonderful for independents. And when a DJ sees a name of a promoter, it means there's some gravitas to what they're presenting to them. Have a listen. Maybe you'll be able to share it with your audience. I'd say 99% of the stuff that is sent is undirected, unproduced. It's somebody's very soulful and spiritual attempt at creating their own music, singing their own songs, having their own band play, but it's not listenable. It's not part of something that you want to be made comfortable with by listening to the big picture, the whole thing. Back in the old days when albums were made on vinyl, and even to the days today, CDs, you had an A&R person who created what was nothing more than an actual show. If you go to a club and hear a show, you start off with something big, an opener, something that knocks you out. And then you have like an exposition period, like a Beethoven sonata. And eventually it'll get to a ballad and there'll be some poignant songs. And it's an arc. It's a curve. It's something that is paced so that it's not all bigger, better, funnier. And it's not all ballads and heartfelt songs. It's an actual arc of a show, and I like to think of recordings, at least CDs, not singles, as that. If you could put the needle down on any song and listen to the entire CD from beginning to end, it's a program that's meant to have you experience the gamut of emotions. That doesn't happen today anymore. It's all louder, faster, funnier, and it's one song. How many people do you know that buy CDs anymore? It's all singles that they download. And, you know, that's to me, that's only about making money. It's not about making art or music.
Right. Well, let me not surprise you, but I don't download the music. I still get CDs. I just find that much easier. And if I like a particular artist, I want to hear a little bit of everything. And so if I really like a CD, I'll play it over and over rather than go from one song with one artist and then, you know, another one to another one. But I guess that's I'm part of the older generation. So now I can say that because I actually can see that there's a difference. And Lee's looking at me like, yeah, he's got a comment. Yep, you can.
I'm actually holding the mic now. Anyway, that's because of what's going on in the studio. But, you know, I had some thoughts about this, actually. I have a lot of thoughts on these kind of things. But it's kind of come full circle because a lot of this revolves around the recording industry and the technology that was available. For example, when Frank Sinatra started recording, I think the medium was a 78 disc, and it had one song on each side, unless they could squeeze more on. Sometimes I think they could, but and then you know, later on you had LPs, and the LPs were the things that dictated, hey, you can go for 40 minutes. If you're Miles Davis, you can go for an hour, you know, 30 minutes each side, so you can present a show. And then with CDs you could even go longer, maybe 80 minutes and maybe 40 minutes, 80 minutes total. Now I think we're back to where you can go on the internet and perhaps have one totally monster song, just one song, and make an impact. Whereas I don't think after, I think it was harder to do that during starting in the late 60s and 70s because the record industry became more album oriented. But I think that presents an opportunity for artists to present, you know, a real monster song and, you know, make an impact. And even if that's the only thing they ever heard from you, people go, hey, did you hear that song? But anyway, the whole point I was trying to make, Russ, is that I think the media that was available that helped to shape how the industry worked. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, sure. I agree with you about the 78s, but that was the technology of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Before that, there were wire recorders. I used to visit Les Paul in his house in northern New Jersey.
Are you kidding me?
And he still had wire recorders. All his stuff has been donated to the Smithsonian. I think there's a section that's called the Les Paul Room or part of their museum. And, you know, as technology evolved, it became a nice evolution to say, hey, we can record more than one song, like an extra play, what they call today, or a long play. And it became a 10-inch vinyl back then, after the 78s, when they slowed down the speed. But in the history of all of that, the best recordings, as far as I'm concerned, and like you mentioned, long songs like Miles, or even the Beatles' Revolution Number 9, they were different, but they were still part of the entire album. So you really had to listen to the whole album to get the whole gist of the music. It was about the music when you got long songs to happen. Nowadays, to get a long song out there, everybody self-produces. So what that has done was destroyed the great places that we've had. It's so easy to record yourself that the great recording studios have gone out of business in New York. There's like only one place left where you can bring in a big band in New York. There used to be like 20 places. All the great places that you saw the great albums of the 50s and 60s recorded in are gone. Same thing in California, except Capitol Records is still there, and they're still recording there. But there's so few because you can go into somebody's house and record this stuff. I know I'm getting off point here, but in the golden age of albums in the 50s and 60s, it was very rare to have a song that was longer than 2 minutes and 30 seconds because of commercial radio. And they always needed to play a commercial, and they always needed to promote things. When the creative people started recording longer than that, those are, to me, the best albums and recordings. Today, I'll agree with you that if a band or an individual wants to record a long song, that's fine. It's very easy to get. I mean, there's so many ways that you can download them. maybe not physically, but digitally. So, you know, it's a long discussion about how all this happened, but I think it all happened because of commercialism, the need to be profitable, and the removal of many music departments in our school systems.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do, speaking of commercials, we're going to go to commercial break. But before we do that, we're going to play something from one of your CDs. Yes, Sir, That's My Baby. And when we come back, we'll talk about it. Show. My guest, Russ Kassoff, legendary pianist. And Russ, tell me a little bit about that song, Yes Sir, That's My Baby.
Well, that's a song written by Walter Donaldson and Gus Kahn way back, I believe, in the 1930s. And it's a song, you know, ever since I was a kid, I was a huge Sinatra fan. And anything Sinatra did, I just devoured. And on his Strangers in the Night album, oddly enough, in 1966, I want to say, or thereabouts, he recorded a swingin' version of that tune. So I've always had it in my repertoire, and any time that I can do something Sinatra or tribute Sinatra in some way, I do it on gigs and with other singers, etc. And to open that particular CD with that, it winds up swinging real hard with my trio, which is Jay Anderson on bass and Dennis McCrell on drums. And they are both extremely well-respected musicians in the world. Dennis, amongst other things, was the conductor of the Count Basie Orchestra. He was handpicked by Joel Williams to join Basie, and he was in the band under the watch when Basie passed. He's just an incredible drummer and a musician. And Jay Anderson plays in the Maria Schneider Orchestra, which won 2 Grammys this past year, one for a co-composition that she did with David Bowie called Sue. And she also won Best Large Ensemble Jazz of the Year. So I've got some really great sidemen on my albums. And how this song plays in is that we all swing. We all swing hard. And we all love to listen to each other and play music with each other. And it was a perfect way to start this particular CD, Bird Fly By.
Okay. Now, I want to go back a little bit. We were talking about Frank Sinatra. You've also performed with Liza Minnelli. So I'd really like to hear some stories about that. I'm a big Judy Garland fan. I saw Liza many years ago in a Broadway show called The Act. What is that like? I mean, these people, it's almost, I don't know, you used the word magical. So I would think that that experience would be magical also.
Well, where do I start? Gee, I was with Liza for 18 years.
Wow.
I did just about every gig she did around the world. We traveled the world about 7 times, all as you could imagine, like first class, unbelievable treatment, and unbelievable venues. The thing about Liza is that the best way for you to appreciate her and her incredible talents was to see her live. It didn't, for some reason, translate onto recording. So we do have some marvelous recordings that I was involved with. I did this historic 17-day run at Carnegie Hall back in 1987, Liza at Carnegie Hall on the Telarc label, and we were with a 44-piece orchestra, I remember that, and we did an incredible run, 2 different long runs, one was about a month at Radio City. And then any venue that you can name around the world, we played under the St. Louis Arch for VP Fair one July 4th. There were 1 million people there. 1 million people. Can you imagine?
No, I'd be petrified. I'd be petrified, but you don't get nervous, right?
Well, there gets a point. Once it gets past 57,206, I stop being nervous.
Okay.
But she, her talents, when she was at the peak of her powers, were unbelievable. And even though she did everything she could to create herself, she's self-made, all her talents, the way she approaches a song, the way she arranges things, and the way she gives 199% of everything she does, she is unique. She's one of a kind. You have to have seen her perform live. There are some there's some great videos, like when we were on tour with Frank and Sammy. That's on video. It's called The Ultimate Event. It was done in 1989. We recorded that in Detroit. Anyway, I'm talking like a DJ now with all that information in my head. You couldn't help but, while you were being captured by her as a performer, seeing her parents in her. Her father was everything. He was such an artist. He was magnificent. He was an Academy Award-winning director. He was a costume designer at Radio City when he first started out. And there was a lot of him in her. And her mother, if you listen to her mother sing, doesn't it make you cry? It's just unbelievable.
It does. Because Over the Rainbow is my theme song. That's my favorite song of all time. That does it for me.
Well, how can you imagine anybody else trying that?
You can't.
You know what I mean? And not only is it a great song, and it's an amazing performance when she was so young, Judy. It's a perfect arrangement. It's an orchestration. It's got the kishkas in it that make you cry, the whole thing. And so there were times that Liza could actually imitate her mother, but she often chose not to do that. She wanted people to enjoy her as herself, and she was able to do that. So I can't even begin with the stories. I mean, we were always treated like kings and queens around the world, and we toured, and there was no such thing as a tour as there is today, like in the jazz world, where you do one-nighters. When we arrived in a town, we did a week in the town. We got a theater. We were in a theater, say the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco, and the first night there'd be an opening night party, and the entire week would be like just totally packed with adoring, rabid fans. And then at the end of the week, we would have a closing night party that would last until we had to get to the airport to fly to the next town. and we would do like six weeks to 3 months all at one time. Sometimes we'd go to Europe for months at a time. We did Japan, Australia, and Hawaii, lots of TV shows. I mean, I was there for all the great years of Liza from 1982 to 2000.
Is she still performing now?
I've kind of lost touch with her. I don't believe she's doing much performing now. I believe she lives in California, and she's had a lot of physical ailments that have prevented her from touring. So I wish that she would be out there performing, but I am not aware that she is.
Okay. Now, I want to play another song, the Edelweiss, off of your CD. So we'll do that, and then we'll talk about it.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell me about that song, Edelweiss. Beautiful song.
Well, it's a song that's not often done. I do believe Sinatra recorded it on a 78, which was just a single in the 1940s. It's just a beautiful song that has always been in my head. On gigs where I play solo piano, I developed it in this kind of soulful, spiritual way. And one of the features of my playing is that less is more. I don't need to play a lot of notes to make my musical point. So in this, it's just a very sweet musical collaboration with the trio, Brushes on the drums and Arco on the bass. So it's something that's really, really pretty, and anyone who hears it, I hope they feel that way.
Now, you also, when you toured with Sinatra, you said you met, you actually knew Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin?
Sure. They were on the gig.
It's just, to me, you know, I look at that and go, oh my God, I wish I was there with you, Russ. What was it like to work with them?
It's indescribable. I mean it's the peak. Yeah. It's like going into the Great Pyramid and just sitting down, and that's it. You're there for eternity. It's unbelievable. I mean, Sammy and Dean, well, Sammy is perhaps one of the most talented people you'll ever meet in your life. He was such a wonderful performer. He had a thing that, like, if you experienced him in performance, it's just like a, I don't know, it's like a Vulcan mind meld or something. It was, he was just great. He's at the top of the list of greats. And Dean, as a human, as a man, as a performer, as an entertainer, he was just so totally cool. Such a great guy. And, you know, Frank has the best voice that ever existed. So, you know, there are some pictures that I took from the pit, from the sides of arenas that we played. You know, the gigs that we did, you couldn't, like, book just a theater for this. You had to have, like, 15,000 people come. Wow. We would do places like the Meadowlands, mm-hmm. or the Spectrum when it was in Philly, or the Miami Arena, and all around the world. We played the Paris Opera. We played soccer stadiums in Ireland and in England and in Japan. I mean, these places were so big. One of the things I think is a little quirky is we played the tennis center in Melbourne where they play the Australian Open, and I'm a tennis player, so I got to play tennis on those courts. It was really fun. Anyway, traveling with Frank and Sammy and Dean, Sammy had his own rhythm section. So I didn't play for his show in that case, but I did play for him when they sang their medleys together. They would come out for like the last 20 to 30 minutes of the show, and they would do medleys of standard tunes, and it would be bang, 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 bang. And I was in the main group for that, and that got me to play for Dean as well. Sammy also was really, really close with Liza and, of course, Judy Garland. So the two of them toured a lot, and I got to play for Sammy in those situations. I mean, it was always great. It was always great.
Did they try to induct you into the Rat Pack?
Induct me?
Yeah. Because you had three of them.
Yeah, that's right.
But you bring up a good idea that maybe I can get all the musicians that played for them together. We call the musicians of the Rat Pack.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. Or at least a Facebook page on that, too. Now, you also have a song called Elegy, a big band song. So I want to play that, and then I want you to talk a little bit about that because it's your big band.
Well, no, that's not a big band cut. It's a trio cut.
Okay.
But it features Adam Niewood, the son of Jerry Niewood, and I'll talk about that on the other side.
All right, we'll play that for you. Hang on.
Thank you.
All right, so tell us about it.
Okay, well, Elegy is one of the most heartfelt things I've ever written. It's an original composition. It's part of a suite that I call Suite for Jerry. Jerry was one of the great musician sax players that ever lived, and he was a member of the Chuck Mangione band when, on a fateful flight to Buffalo, he perished. And when he died, it was just such a shock to the entire music community. I worked with Jerry all the way back to 1982 with Liza. Before that, if you were a Met fan and you went to Shea Stadium, you may remember that there was a classic concert by Simon and Garfunkel back in the late 70s at Shea Stadium. And they always played like video from that concert, and he was the sax player in that band at that time, so you always got to see him. Anyway, he played all the instruments in the woodwind section, and he was a founding member of my big band, which was founded in the year 2000. So it took me about a year to write this, but we were all in such shock. I wrote a suite, a three-movement suite that featured all the instruments that he played in the band: soprano sax, alto flute, flute, alto sax, and tenor. And this is a soprano sax. And the performance on this record, I asked his son Adam, who is an amazing musician. He plays all the saxes and drums as well. I asked him to come into the studio and play the solo on that with our trio, and that's how I closed that particular CD in tribute and memory to Jerry.
Now, do you have more CDs coming out soon?
I do. I'm in the post-production stage of a third trio CD called I Can Dream. And it's pretty much all about looking up in the sky and dreaming about positive thoughts and hope and promise, something that is very hard to find these days in our climate here on this earth.
I agree. And I think Lee had another question about Les Paul.
Yeah. Wow, that really piqued my interest. This is, you could do a whole show on this, right? But I know a little bit about Les Paul, that he was one of the first technicians to use multi-track recording, and you went to, was it, you, did you see the actual studio that he did that in?
No, I went to his home. He lived up in Ramsey, New Jersey, which is one of the northernmost towns.
I thought he did it in his home originally. No, he did the multi-track.
You're breaking up. I'm sorry.
Oh. He's asking, did you do the multi-track recording in his home at all or not?
I don't think so. What he had were the devices, the recorders and stuff that were still there. He wasn't running them. I mean, we actually played. I played on his piano and he played on his guitar. We used to play tunes. What had happened was, this is kind of a funny story. I've been with working and playing with Bucky Pizzarelli also since like the early 1980s. I used to be a member of his trio at the Pierre Hotel in the Café Pierre. We actually did an album. And I often play it on my radio show. And Bucky and Les Paul and all the great guitarists are all the best of friends. They all love to play with each other. They love to play gigs and make concerts, 20 guitars, 2 guitars, 5, whatever. And for years when I was traveling with Frank Sinatra and with Liza Minnelli, I would get the call to do Les's gig. He had a steady Monday night at the Iridium in New York City, and it became an institution. All the tourists would come, the place would be packed, and he had a great band, and I kept getting asked to sub for John Coliani, who was the regular pianist in his quartet, and I was never ever to make it. Somehow, they always called me when I was in some place like London or Germany or something like that, and I was never able to do it. But I never spoke to Les. And then Bucky told me he kept on trying to get Les to give me a call whenever he needed a piano player. So I don't remember the year, but Les was just 90 years old. And I get a phone call. I pick up the phone, and he says, "Russ, Les Paul." And without hesitation, I said, "Well, that only took you 90 years." And he started laughing hysterically, and we became great friends for the last couple of years of his life. And he wanted me to come over and go over his repertoire and play the tunes that he would likely play at the club in the event we could ever work it out. And we never did, because I never was available. And I regret that. I wish I could have done that. That's but I did get to play with him one-on-one in his house. And I went over there several times. It was a lot of fun.
That is so impressive. Well, since you've hung out with all the famous musicians and celebrities of that era, now I have a question. Did you ever go down and see Woody Allen? You're in New York. You're in New York City, right? Doesn't Woody play like a Monday or Tuesday night gig every week, or used to?
I'm not sure if he's still doing it. He keeps it so low key. There's very little publicity. But it used to be at the Carlisle, in the Cafe Carlisle. And he would play kind of like an old-style New Orleans Dixieland on an Albert System clarinet, which is a clarinet that's older than the regular B-flat clarinets that you hear now. No, I never went down to hear him play, but I did appear in two of his movies, and I did get to talk to him several times.
What movies?
I'm in the movie Alice. I have a great scene that lasts about 29 seconds.
Movie.
And I'm standing at the piano. It's an upright piano in a rehearsal studio where Joe Montagna is about to rehearse his big band, and Mia Farrow walks in. And I'm furiously writing music on the top of the piano. And for some reason, the camera leaves me and goes to them. I mean, what is that about?
Wow. Yeah, it should have been about you.
You should have
told. They had a whole scene.
Hey, wait.
And
you're misdirecting this.
I wound up playing a recording. I think it was "Bye Bye Blackbird," with the great Joe Wilder and Jack Verry on guitar. Joe Wilder was a great trumpet player, and so you can actually hear us playing in the background during that scene. And the other one was cut from the movie. It was Broadway Danny Rose. I did get called to be the piano player in that movie, but again, I was in London for a month with Liza, and I couldn't get back in time. But I did get back in time to be in an incidental scene with a band that was behind a male singer, I don't remember who it was, and the feature of that scene was that they were making the emergency announcement that Pearl Harbor had just been bombed,
wow.
And we were supposed to act appropriate to the announcement. So that was my movie career with Woody Allen.
By the way, this is my last comment. Have you heard? He has a new movie coming out, Cafe Society. I think it's out now in limited release or whatever. But it looks really interesting. It's set in the 30s in sort of a bi-coastal New York Hollywood thing. So I'm excited to see that.
Sounds interesting. Well, Russell, we're getting ready to wrap up, but just tell me, where are you and or your band playing coming up?
Well, I can tell you that the week of August 22nd, I will be back at Bryant Park each day from 12:30 to 2:30 in New York City at the piano. It's called Piano in the Park. It's a really beautiful experience. I don't know the dates that I have to go from based on the syndication of this program, but this Saturday, I know you're not going to air it before now, I'll be appearing with Robert Davi, the great actor and Sinatra tributer. I'll actually be with him in New York at 54 Below, which is now called Feinstein's 54 Below, and that's August 18, 19, and 20. After that, let's see, my big band is playing a concert for the Emergency Relief Fund of Local 802, which is the Musicians Union, and that's a really worthwhile cause. It's free to the public. It's on October 27th at 5 p.m. in Midtown Manhattan. Just look up Local 802. I'll be playing various and sundry gigs around the New York metropolitan area, and you can find out about them by going to my calendar at my website, which is russkassoff.com, russkassoff.com. And you can purchase my CDs through cdbaby.com. Just search for Russ Kassoff. And if you'd like to send me an email, you can send an email to russkjazzdirector@gmail.com. And if you'd like to listen to the Jazz Deli with Russ Kassoff, which is live every Saturday from 10 to 12 in the morning, where our tongue sandwiches speak for themselves, you can go to wfdu.fm and click on Listen to HD2. And your devices, like laptops and desktops and iPhones, will all be able to hear it instantly.
You know the routine, Russell. I want to thank you again for being with me today. And join us next week on The World of Laurie Zook.